Any questions? All right, your first programming assignment, like I said, was out on Tuesday, and it's due 3 weeks from Tuesday, which I guess is the 23rd. It's a pretty straightforward assignment. Essentially, you get to pick a data structure, a linked sequential data structure, either a linked list, a stack, or a queue, and decorate it with animation commands so that when you run it, you'll see little pictures about how your data structure is being manipulated and being used. So from that point of view, it's a relatively simple assignment. Now, the reason it could very well be complicated for some people is that you have to use Java in a reasonably sophisticated way. I didn't actually initially like the way I did it, this assignment, but the more I think about it, the more interesting I think it is. I will say one thing. You need to implement a strict definition. So, for example, if you implement a stack, which we will talk about next week, you need to implement the stack strictly. In other words, the only elements that you can access on the stack are the head of the stack. If you implement a queue, then you have to allow only reading on the head and writing on the tail. You can't read or write any other elements. It's important that you do that because it turns out one of the things I can do is I can lard the code that I provide you with tests. I was actually wondering how I was going to do this because what I did was I wrote tests in your turn-in assignments. But the problem there, of course, is that's too late. You turn in your code and you see it won't work and there's nothing else you can do. Then it occurred to me, hey, I could put the test in the jar file so that when you run the jar file, your code will explode right in front of your face for maximum impact. And I'm going to do that, too. That's one of the reasons I'm starting to like this way of doing things. So it's important that you implement the data structure strictly because you don't have to indicate which one of these you implemented, linked list, stacks, or queues. My code will figure that out or try and figure it out, and we'll do that using properties associated with linked list, stacks, and queues. And if it can't do that, if it's ambiguous or it can't figure out what the hell you did at all, it's going to explode. And, of course, exploding code doesn't garner much favor. As I said, this is doing some reasonably sophisticated things. If you don't know how to use jar files, you're going to learn really quick. So my recommendation is you get cracking right now. In fact, if you haven't done anything on the assignment from Tuesday, you're behind. Because there's a lot of things here that my suspicion is a lot of you don't have experience with, and you're going to need to get experience with it. Because if you wait until the last minute, you're absolutely doomed. What I'd like to do, are there any questions about the assignment itself? Like I said, it's a reasonably simple one. So my suspicion is there probably wouldn't be that many questions. Yes, sorry.
Just as I wasn't here on Tuesday, where do we find it? Is it on eCampus?
No, it's on the syllabus.
Oh, it's on the syllabus. Okay.
On the syllabus. Everything that's going to be available is going to be off the syllabus someplace.
Okay.
Any other questions? All right. What I want to do is I want to spend a little time talking about the turn-in, how you're going to turn your code in. Actually, to a certain extent, since the tests are going to be in the jar file that you run, it doesn't really make that much difference. But I do want to talk about the turn-in a little bit. The turn-in is email-based, and one of the things you should do when this class is done is you should run to the nearest terminal and turn in something. It doesn't matter what, just turn it in, just so you have some experience in doing turn-in. If you wait until the last minute, I'll guarantee you, you'll screw it up. And when you screw it up, of course, it's going to take you longer than you thought to turn it in, which means that your code's going to be late, and bang, you immediately lose 5 points, which my suspicion is going to be 5 very precious points that you probably can't afford to lose. So my advice is to just have an empty Java file. You don't have to actually write anything. Just touch a Java file and turn it in, just to make sure you understand how things work. The other thing that's important is end-to-end, from when you submit to when you get something back, it's all done by programs. There's no human beings in the loop there, all right? Which means a couple of things. First of all, it means that you really can't screw around. You have to follow the directions. If you don't follow the directions, the code is not going to understand. I wrote all the code, so it's not very good. It's not very smart. So if it gets confused, it just says, oops, you know, this is wrong, and it'll send you a message back. So you got to make sure that you follow the directions. Because if you don't, your code will be rejected, and if your code is late, then, again, you're losing points. There are some other more common questions on the addendum to the assignment, which is the turn-in instructions. Again, I recommend that you read the turn-in instructions. I looked at them, and I probably have to rewrite them. They originally were, I wrote this when we were dealing with C++. And it's still a little bit C++-centric, so I have to go back and rewrite it, or at least make it less C++-centric and more Java-centric. but I do recommend that you get familiar with it. I mean, if you, I assume everyone's used email before, but if you've never used email, you might want to figure that out too, because as I said, your submissions are going to be via email, and the results are going to come back to you via email. And I think that's about all I wanted to say about that. Any questions? All right. Last time, we started in on linked lists, and where did we end up? I attempted to motivate the idea behind linked lists by looking at arrays, which is something I'm going to do, as I mentioned, over and over again. We looked at arrays, and we saw the nice properties they have. We saw some of the unnice properties they have, and we principally abstracted that down to the idea that arrays were static. They were fixed size. You couldn't make a bigger array if you needed it, or if you made an array too big, you couldn't make it smaller to save space. We said, well, we'd like to have all the good things about arrays, but in addition, we would like to maintain this dynamic property. So by looking at an array and figuring out what's good and what's bad and casting those in terms of trade-offs, we were able to tweak the trade-offs that gives us arrays to get a different data structure, and that different data structure was a linked list. Although I don't know if I've specifically identified it as a linked list yet. Trade-offs properties, some of the more important properties, we're actually going to come back to that. Are we going to come back to that today? I think we are going to come back to that today. Adding and removing elements. So the operations, once we get this set of trade-offs set, we have a new data structure, and then we can start thinking about, well, all right, it's an ADT, needs an interface, what do I want to see in the interface? This is a discussion on traversals, which we'll spend more time on today once we get done with this. Then the question comes up, fine, we have our new data structure, we have cast that in the form of an ADT, which means we have an interface supporting the operations, we know what the semantics of the operations are. We didn't go into that into any great detail, but there's a lot of choices there. And you can pick and choose as you want. Now the question is, how do you implement it? Essentially, there are two approaches that I talked about. There's actually a lot of approaches, but the two principal ones that we're going to be talking about is an array-based implementation and then a dynamic storage-based implementation. And someone pointed out here last time that, gosh, you know, we've implemented this abstract data type to get away from the problems associated with arrays, in particular its static nature. But here we are implementing our new fabulous WYSI data structure in terms of arrays. And I gave some justification for that. This will actually turn out to be a little bit more important when we get to trees, because the static implementation of trees turns out to be a fairly useful technique. But it's also kind of interesting, if not perhaps useful, when we talk about linked lists, too. And actually, there are more than one way to implement linked lists using arrays. I'm just talking about a particularly simple one. There are others which I don't talk about. This is the implementation. Again, you have an array, and you have a pointer to the last element in the array that represents the location of either the first or the last element in the sequence, depending upon how you want to interpret it. And then we spent an enormous amount of time talking about list element references. So you put things in. Now you want to be able to talk about these things that are in the array, in the linked list ADT. And actually, I didn't notice whether or not I defined it as a linked list. I suspect I did. This point. So now we can actually talk about linked list ADT since we've identified them. I don't think we got this far. Actually, I don't even think we got that far. This is where we stop, right? Okay. So are there any questions about what we talked about up to this point? All right. So now we can go on. And we talked about the problem of the phantom reference, where you have a reference to an element and the element moves and all of a sudden you no longer have a reference, and how can we deal with that? One answer is, well, you just say, too bad, that's life. You know, sometimes somebody crashes into your car and sometimes they don't. Oh, well. On the other hand, you could say that, well, you know, there are some things we can do. And we started talking about this double array implementation where the reference to elements in your linked list data structure actually don't refer directly to the element in the array, but refer to the element in an array of indices that then refer to elements in the array. And that level of indirection gives you the ability to play around and maintain the references to the values as the values in the array in the linked list data structure move around. The question where we left it was, how do you deal with that? For example, I guess the particular question came up, if you have a reference to the first element, and then you add a new element at the beginning, and then you take a reference to the first element again. And that was, I think, the question where we stopped. And that's what all this was, store pseudo indices. in the elements. And essentially, it's just another approach to solving problems by adding another level of indirection. Indirection is very powerful. You can always just add another level of indirection to solve your problems. I keep talking about putting things in and taking things out, and we haven't talked about how you do that. How do you put something into the array, and how do you take something out? We mentioned the mechanism by which you can specify that. You say, you know, here's a reference. I want you to insert a new value before or after the value referenced by this element. Sorry, this value referenced by the reference that you have. You can also specify something relative to an implicit reference. For example, you can say insert first or insert last. That way, you don't need a reference. You can just assume that you know where the ends of the array are or ends of the linked list. But what do you actually do? How do you implement insert before and insert after, or insert first or insert last? How do you do that? The answer is pretty straightforward, although it actually doesn't necessarily need to be. You essentially shuffle things around. If you look at this implementation, there is an interesting property here. And what is that property? If you look at that implementation of a linked list based on array, what kind of property can you state about that array? It's actually perhaps hard to see here in this picture. It might be a little bit easier to see in this picture. Yes?
It has a fixed number of spaces.
That's true. But since we're interested in adding things and removing things, we'll actually have to deal with that in a minute. I think we deal with it somewhere. But anything else more in line with the idea of putting things in and taking things out?
There's more room to put things in than that one. Like, it's not full yet.
I guess the question is, how do you know that? How do you know there's more room? In particular?
The last three.
Okay, so the point here is that there's a dividing line. At any point during the lifetime of the list ADT, there's a dividing line in the array. Everything to the left, in this case, is going to be values. Everything to the right is going to be empty. Okay, that's the property, or what's known as an invariant, for this data structure. It's one of them anyway. There are other ones. Maintaining that property is essentially going to be our job when we implement manipulations on this. Now, you don't have to maintain this property. There are other properties that you can perhaps think of that would allow you to come up with a somewhat more efficient set of operations for the array implementation of linked lists. But then, on the other hand, there are some operations that would become more expensive. This is the perhaps simplest approach to take, which is like everything on the left end is in use, everything on the right end is free. With that in mind, the question now becomes, how do you add an element into a linked list with this implementation? Under the constraint that you have to be able to say, oh, everything to the left is full, everything to the right is empty. Well, it's pretty much the only thing you can do, or at least the only thing I can think of. Oh, we're not going to do that yet. This is static. So the array is n elements. That was some other invariant that somebody mentioned, right? So the array is n elements long, and that's it. No, I'm saying that let's assume it's not full. We're not going to worry about that. Let's assume it's in this state or this state. So we have empty stuff on one end and full stuff on the other.
Assuming that there's space to the right, just insert it before or after and then slide everything to the right.
Exactly. That's about the only thing you can do. If I ask to insert the value apparently 2 before 3, or before the element, before the value referenced, which in this case happens to be 3, then pretty much the only thing you can do is slide everything one over to the left, and then you have a free space here. We're not allowed to have free spaces mixed up with occupied spaces, so then that's where I put the 2. Similarly, in the other direction, I say I'm pointing at this value, and I'm saying get rid of it, remove it. See, this is where the difference is. If you're inserting something, well, yeah, it's pretty obvious that the only thing you can do is slide stuff over to make room. But if I say get rid of this too, now it becomes less clear, right? Because what's an alternative thing you can say? One thing, all right, let me just say one thing. One thing you can say is, all right, I have to get rid of the 2, so I just get rid of it. Now there's a gap here, right? So I have to now, to maintain that invariant about everything to the left and everything to the right, I have to slide everything back over again to get this. So this is the insertion direction from here to here. This is the deletion from here to here. All right, pretty straightforward. It does have one unfortunate characteristic, which I'll come back to, but let's think about deletion from here to here. So we have to get rid of this, But what else can we do instead of sliding things around?
Replace it.
Replace it with what? Which? Pick one.
Five.
Okay, so you're trying to maintain this invariant. Right? That's why you're saying replace it. Well, there's something else you can say too, which is the hell with the invariant. Which means what? If I say I'm not going to pay attention to the invariant anymore, what does that mean? What's the invariant? Okay, what's the invariant? Or I'm sorry, what's the property that we discovered here?
All values on the left right. And blank spaces to the right.
All right, everything to the left has values in it, or is full if you want. Everything to the right is empty. Right. So suppose we say, well, screw that. I don't want to use that invariant anymore.
But you can just delete it and just not slide it. Just be a blank space there.
Right. In fact, it turns out that you won't even have to delete it. You don't have to do anything. Well, you do have to do one thing. But, yeah, that's right. So another possibility, another way to implement this data structure is to just say, well, this is no longer here. This is really not a two. Right. This is a free space. And now what we're saying is, okay, we can intermix free spaces and spaces that are full. Why would I do such a thing? As you can see, that's kind of getting a little complicated, right? Because now I got to keep track. It's like, is this two here or is it not here? And that's why, you know, replacing it with a value is the right answer, but we have to be careful about the value. But first, let's think about why we might want to do that, because that looks like it's going to be a pain.
Get rid of phantom references? Or like, so that you don't have to keep changing all the references every time you do something?
See, yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, so at least when you're talking about deletion, well, yes, you're right. The problem is it's kind of difficult to say exactly what your benefits are. It's true that there are some phantom references you won't have to worry about. On the other hand, if you think about it and carry this through, it's more like you shift phantom references around when you're delaying them when they occur, is another way to think about it. But yes, that's true. But there's a more fundamental reason.
I guess if you replace it, it's like maybe zero or something, then it's like a placeholder if you want to add anything back.
Right. Right, but why would I want to do that? What's the point?
So that way you know it's supposed to represent an empty space?
Yes, but why? I mean, first of all, notice that that's a difficult thing. Because if these are integers, what am I going to use to indicate an empty space? Can I use an integer? Can I use zero? No, because zero is a value you can store. Right? So that's why it's a little tricky. That's even why it's even more tricky, is I need to be able to distinguish between empty cells in the array and non-empty ones. The easiest way to do that, of course, is to have another array, the same size as the data array that has, for example, Boolean values, and the array name would be full. So if the corresponding element in the Boolean array is true, then the corresponding element in the value array contains a value, otherwise it doesn't. As you can see, it's getting all complicated here. So the question is, why are we doing it? Why are we going through this excess complication? What is the thing we are trying to avoid doing when we just said, well, you know, everything to the left is full and everything to the right is empty? This is actually a more general point about looking at data structures, designing data structures. So that's why I'm sort of hammering on it here, because we're going to be hammering on it all semester. It's another way to distinguish data structures. Well, let's talk about costs. And let's go back to our old implementation, where everything to the left is full and everything to the right is empty. How much does it cost me to insert something? What do I have to do?
Slide everything to the right.
Right. So essentially, and it depends, of course, right? If I want to insert something at the end of the linked list, it doesn't cost me anything, right? But if I want to insert something at the beginning, I have to move everything over. Well, so what? What's the big deal? Right, it costs time to actually do the movement. And there's a cardinal rule in doing any kind of programming, but certainly in data structure design, and that is touch the data as infrequently as you can and never move the data. Moving data is extremely expensive. Touching data is expensive, but moving it is very expensive. So what you want to do is you want to touch the data as infrequently as you can, and you absolutely don't want to move it. So that's the thing that we're afraid of. That's why we don't like this idea of, well, slide everything over one. It turns out to be really expensive. And that's just justification for going through hoops and saying that, okay, in order to avoid or at least decrease the number of times I have to touch things and move things around, let me have a secondary array that keeps track of the full and available elements in the value array and so forth and so on. So that's a justification for going through all that nonsense. All right? Again, that's a really important property, both in terms of writing your own code and writing data structures for libraries. If you write your own code, you want to make sure that, first of all, you're using data structures that don't overly manipulate the data, because those are going to be expensive. And you want to make sure that your code does not overly manipulate the data, because, again, that's going to be very expensive. And we'll come back to that over and over again. Yes, sorry.
So then, I guess, you say the correct implementation for every array of integers or values that we're using, should we, I guess we should have two other arrays. So one is the reference to refer to those values, and then there's a Boolean true or false to say if it's full or not.
That, well, let me, you said a magic word there, so now we have to go back and deal with that. The magic word was correct. All right, correct is a technical term.
Right.
And essentially, if you're a software engineer, it has lots of different definitions, but I'm essentially going to say that correct means it behaves the way you expect it to. And by behaves, I'm going to talk about the interface. All right. So correct is probably not the right word to use.
Maybe most efficient as opposed to saying correct.
I will say the word you should use is appropriate.
Okay.
The appropriate, most appropriate data structure. Now, if you replace correct with appropriate, you're exactly right, and that's a very important property. So what you end up with is you end up with lots of different implementations of linked lists using arrays. Mm-hmm. Right? You have this one, which just phantom references all over the place, sliding things, touching data, moving it around, doing all kinds of awful things. Right? It has the advantage, though, of being very quick to implement and obviously correct. Then we have this other implementation based on arrays again that we talked about on Tuesday with the second array that's the indirection for references. That deals with phantom references. Okay, but what we did, and I think we talked about that, we doubled the amount of space that was assigned. Now, that may or may not be appropriate. It depends upon the importance of avoiding phantom references. If you have code that doesn't either cause or care about phantom references, then this is much better, because you don't have that extra space, you don't have that extra complexity. On the other hand, if you're writing code that, in fact, crucial that you don't have phantom references, or phantom references could occur that can't be detected, then you absolutely want to use this code over here. So what you need to have, in fact, is a whole bunch of implementations, each one that's different in certain sets of properties. And then the task is to pick the appropriate one. That is another one of my secret hidden long-term objectives, is to get you thinking along that path, because that's why people are going to pay you money. Right? They're going to pay you money to figure out what the most appropriate data structure is given a set of choices. Otherwise, they just hire high school students to read books or copy, cut and paste off the web. But what you need to be able to do is to develop that ability to look at the data structures, analyze their properties, and then map those properties to the appropriate ones for the problem you're trying to solve. Similarly, when you're writing your own data structures, we had explicitly talked about this. Right? If you have a problem that has a set of requirements and none of your data structures satisfy all of those requirements, now you're in a position where you need to write a new version of that data structure that does. So yes, that's right. That's exactly right, except replace correct with appropriate. We actually are not going to spend that much time talking about correctness, unfortunately. Okay, so that's it. So what else do we have? All right, and then the question is, what do you do here if there's no more space? We'll talk about that in a minute. At least with respect to this approach to implementing things, it's simple. You just slide things left and right. All right, now we're going to talk a little bit about traversal operations. We're actually going to talk a lot more about it when we get to the lecture for tonight. If you remember, I identified lots of different ways of, well, at least three anyway, of implementing traversals through data structures, and in particular the index sequential data structures, but data structures in general. And what I'm going to talk about here is the most basic one, the simplest one, which is essentially I'm going to give you the pieces that you can assemble using for loops or whatever other control structures you have around. What we're going to implement are operations to support the explicit for loop style, as we will discover tonight. These can also serve as navigation operations. I'm actually going to split those apart when we get to tonight's lecture, but for now I'll lump them together. And when you do this, what you have is essentially a reference variable that you can move through the data structure. And when you have that kind of reference variable, it's sometimes called a cursor. It's called other things too, but principally it's called a cursor, particularly in databases. You may, those of you that have worked in databases may be familiar with the idea of a cursor. So you have the usual operations. You start, you return a reference to the first element, or you set the cursor to the first element if you want. You advance the cursor to the next element, either forwards or backwards, depending on how you want to define it. And then you have a predicate that determines whether or not there are any more values. Because these are essentially references, you have the phantom reference problem if you modify the data structure while it's being traversed. That's always going to be the case. And that's how you would implement a linked list using an array. Or, let me not say that, that is one of the ways you can implement a linked list using an array. It's perhaps the most simplest way. Any questions about that? Okay, so let's compare. What have we got? We've implemented a new data structure. Let's compare it to an array. All right. So let's look at the operations that you can provide on a linked list. And let's figure out how expensive they are in terms of, well, in this case, in terms of being fast or slow. And we'll actually be able to quantify those in greater detail in the third section of this course. But for now, we'll just say fast and slow, and we'll figure out what fast and slow means. So creating arrays and create, pretty much as you might expect, everything's the same, right? Because we're using an array to implement a list. So whatever the properties of arrays are, you're going to have similar properties associated with lists. It's fast to create a list. It's also fast to create an array-based linked list. Not a linked list, just a list now. It is fast to delete. Adding is slow. Why is it slow? Either in an array or a linked list. Sorry, not a linked list, just a list. Why is it slow? Right, it's the moving thing. You have to potentially move every element over one. That's the worst thing you can do. Same thing with remove. Traversals are fast because you're essentially dealing with indexing. Now, this is interesting. Navigation is fast for arrays but slow for lists. Why is that? This is the one place where everything breaks, right? Pretty much everything else is the same except here, navigation. Why is navigation fast for arrays but slow for lists? Moving around the array, right, or moving through, let me not say that, moving through the values in the data structure. Here we're moving through the values in the array. Here we're moving through the values in the list. And the question is, why is this fast and why is this slow?
Because in the list you go through a reference to get to the values?
Well, that's true, but it's not significant. Well, that may or may not be true. For example, if we implement references just as indices, if we do that indirection, then yeah, you have to make two hops instead of one. But hardware is optimized for that. So that's, you're right, it's slower to go two hops than one, but not significantly so. Okay, this is a significant difference in speed. And the question is, pardon me, why is that? How would that affect navigation, though?
I don't know.
Well, that's the question. You're also thinking at the wrong level. What kind of data structure are we defining here? Go all the way back to the beginning. What kind are we defining here? What is a list? It's an abstract data type, but how would you characterize the way in which the data are presented in that abstract data type? There's one word that can answer that question. Actually, you can do it. There are two words you can use if you want. Yes, that's true, but that's not quite the word. All right. Yes, there we go. Well, which is well, they're both ordered, so you're on the right track, but you got to be a little more careful.
The array more so.
Right, so now you have to tell me what more so means. There's a technical term you can use for more so. And if you do that, we'll be done. And I think we talked about this, so you have to dredge this up from your past. Well, since we have to get going, this is a random access data structure. All right. I'm sorry. This is a random access data structure, which means yeah, what does that mean, though?
It's coded, like, in the hardware.
That's how it's implemented. That doesn't tell me what it means. So what's a consequence of it? Well, no, I don't want to say that. That's not accurate. What's a consequence of, well, no, I don't even want to pursue that. You're right, but that's not relevant. What did random access mean? It is essentially location-independent access. It doesn't matter where you want to access an element in an array. It takes the same amount of time. Right? I want to access the first element of the array. You can do it in microseconds, nanoseconds. The last element, same amount of time. Middle, doesn't matter. Any element can be accessed in the same amount of time. This, on the other hand, a list data structure is not random access. It is... Yes. And another word for not random access? Not read-only. It's sequential. All right, it's a sequential data structure, which means what? Remember that before and after relationship we worked so hard to maintain?
That you have to go through everyone before.
Exactly. If I want the only movements I can do in a sequential data structure is one step forward and possibly one step back. So if I want to get to the end of a list, the only way to do that is to start at the beginning and chunk through every element, right? So that's why an array is fast in navigation, but a list is slow. The important one here is dynamic. Neither one of these are dynamic, which is kind of pointless because that's the reason we went off on this little adventure. We want something that allows us to stuff as many values as we can in our data structure, and we don't have that here. All right, fast, the meaning of fast and slow, fast essentially means a single element operation. Right? If you want to do something, you just have to worry about a single element or no element at all. Okay. Slow, on the other hand, means potentially I have to deal with every element in the data structure. All right, and that's why navigation is slow, that's why removing and adding is slow, because potentially if you want to add into an array and you want to add at the beginning of the array, you have to push everything over, and that's potentially... manipulating n elements, or n minus 1 elements. So that's what fast and slow mean here. Yes, sorry.
What's the distinction between traversal and navigation?
Traversal is an organized form of... Traversal is essentially navigation that touches every element.
Okay.
Right, navigation, I can say something like, you know, give me the third element from the end.
Okay.
Whereas traversal says, I want... We'll actually talk about that tonight. But traversal says, I want to look at every element. I want to find everyone who's on the dean's list.
Okay.
Right? I have to essentially touch every element. And the other way to think about it is, I don't really care what order you give them to me.
Right.
I just want to see all the students so I can figure out which ones belong on the dean's list. Whereas navigation says, you know, here I am, give me the next student or give me the student previous. Although you're right, your intuition is right. These are essentially related fairly tightly, as we'll talk about. But the thing I want to focus on now is this. I mean, we actually want to take care of this so that we can say yes here and satisfy what we had originally set off to do. So let's do that. Now we'll take a look at the second approach to implementing lists, which is the dynamic approach. And that gives us the ability to have varying numbers of elements that we don't have to predefine. So the tight coupling between storage and arrays are the things that make arrays static. That is why arrays are static, as a couple of you mentioned. Now, if we don't want to have static arrays, well, there's a couple things you can do, but the thing we're going to do now is we're going to break that coupling between memory and the data structure, the array. Okay, we're going to go in there and stick our little screwdriver in there and pry it away. That essentially gives you now the ability to increase or decrease the size of the array because it's no longer directly tied to memory. But the problem is you have also broken the before and after relationship because the thing that gave you before and after are the addresses in main storage. Okay, everyone's taken, what's the hardware course? Computer structures or whatever they call it?
Architecture.
Architecture, that's it, yes. Is everybody taking architecture?
Taking it right now.
Taking it right now. Okay. Who teaches that?
Dr. Dong?
I don't even know who that is. Huh? Oh, okay. Okay. So I guess you haven't gotten that far yet. But that's the point. If we break that tie between hardware, memory hardware, and the data structure itself, then we make it dynamic. But we also lose the idea of before and after, because we can no longer say that, well, you know, after this element is essentially just the address of this element plus an offset. Right? We no longer have that. So that's another responsibility that we'll have to maintain, because again, lists are sequential. They do have this before and after relationship. So by, and again, this is the trade-off here coming back. By making the data structure dynamic, we now have to incur a greater cost in maintaining that before and after. Now, of course, we can throw away the before and after relationship and we end up with sets. But the point is we don't want to do that. We want to keep the before and after relationship, which means that we're going to have to do it ourselves. When you do that, one of the ways that you can do it is known as a linked list. Now I can talk about linked lists. So what we have are essentially elements or values in my data structure. Okay, but now, because they're not tied to specific locations in storage, I have to maintain the relationship between them in addition to maintaining the value. Okay, which is easy enough to do. You just have to keep track of where the next element is or the previous element is, or both, depending upon what you're implementing. And you can do both of those. You can implement what's known as a singly linked list, which essentially carries only the after information. So given a particular element, you can tell which element comes after it. Okay. Notice that given a particular element, you don't have a readily available way to tell which element is before it, because you don't have that information. The only thing you know is after. Okay? Just as a piece of terminology, this is known as going downstream, because you're following essentially the reference information, the pointer information. This way is known as going upstream, because you're going against the current, if you will. And that's always difficult. The other alternative, of course, is to have a doubly linked list which maintains both the before and after information. But of course, you pay for that in terms of twice the storage overhead. Now, instead of having one pointer, you have two, so you've doubled your overhead. All right, and from this picture, everything else should follow. It should be fairly clear how we add new elements to our data structure. It actually turns out to be a little tricky, as we'll see on the next slide. But just looking at this, it's like, does anybody not see how this is dynamic? All right, it's pretty straightforward. If you want to add a new value into this linked list, you just create one and thread it in with all the other ones at the appropriate place. Similarly, to get rid of a value, you figure out which value you want to get rid of, and you yank it out, maintaining the pointers, as we'll see in a minute. So yeah, this looks like it's dynamic, and it's sequential. So this looks like it's going to give us what we want, but at least we're going to pay for it in terms of extra storage and also increased complexity, as we'll see. Questions about this? I mean, this is it. If you understand this, then you're done. All right? All right, so what do links look like? What do these things look like? These things are, we can call links, you can call them nodes. I generally call them nodes, although I notice here on the lecture notes I call them links, probably because it's like a linked list. So what do these things look like? Well, not too surprising. You have some class that's, in this case, called a node, and then you have the data that you're storing, the value, and then depending upon whether you're doing singly or doubly linked list, you have a reference to the next node and a reference to the previous. Pretty straightforward. You could have some other things in there too if you want, but these are the principal things. You also need to know where the list starts, okay? And that's usually referred to as the head of the list. You can also call it the beginning of the list or the start of the list. But when we get to queues, you talk about heads and tails, so this is sort of consistent with that. And depending upon, again, the properties you would like to have, you might keep an element count for a constant time size operation, right? Size returns the number of values in the linked list. How would I compute size here? How would I implement size given this kind of internal representation of my sequential list?
By the number of pointers or links?
Yeah, but how do I find that out?
That's a good question.
Well, there's at least two ways to do it. Expensive way and a cheap way. So what's the expensive way? Well, how do I figure out how many links are on, for example, this linked list? Sorry? Yeah, how many elements, how many values, how many links, right, same thing. Each, if we look at this definition, each link or node contains a single value. Right, so count them, right? So you just whiz through and count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All right. But that's going to, what am I doing there? I'm doing something very bad. I said was very bad. Yes, I'm navigating. That's a good, well, actually now you could argue I'm traversing, right? Because you want to touch every node, because if you don't, you're going to get a bad count. But I'm doing something, and besides, navigation isn't bad. But I am doing something bad.
I'm talking about in terms of speed, if it's a count, I don't mean, but I guess you've got to have the count as well.
Right? Yes, right. But is that good or bad? Well,
you're indicating it's bad.
I'm indicating it's bad. So the question is, why do I indicating it's bad? What am I doing that's bad in that implementation of size? Exactly, I'm touching every element, right? And I said that's bad, and the reason it's bad is it's going to take time. You know, imagine that this is not 5, but 5 million, right? Or 50 million. Right? That's going to take you a long time to do that. So the other alternative is to keep track in a separate value the number of times that you add something in and take something out. That way you can answer the question, how many elements are there, by returning that value. And notice that it only takes, it takes time independent of the number of values in the linked list, right? Because every time you add an element, you put one, you add one to that count. Every time you delete an element, you subtract one. So that takes constant time, and I don't have to touch every element to return size. So here's an example of a smarter implementation that will save you a lot of time. And of course, you can have other things too in your implementation. You probably will have other things, but these are the basics. All right. Questions about that? I mean, that's essentially, that's the essence of a dynamically implemented list, which we call now a linked list. Now we can think about, how do you add and remove things? The principal problem with adding and removing things is a little bit more tricky than it is for dealing with an array-based list. Because you have to maintain these pointers in the appropriate way. Right? But even when you do that, there are actually some tricky things that you have to worry about. Let's take the example of a singly linked list. Now, if I'm going to implement the add operation, so I want to add the value 4 relative to R1, the reference R1. Okay? What did I say? Oh, yes, the value 4. Now, I have two choices, well, actually three choices, right? I can pick, for the semantics of this operation, what are those three choices? There's three ways I can define adding an element to a linked list through a reference. What are those three ways?
Next.
Exactly. I can add it before the referenced element or value. I can add it after the referenced value, or the third one. I can replace the reference, right? The replace is easy, right? I just take the value that's pointed to and do an assignment. So that one we don't worry about. But before and after is tricky. Which one would you prefer to implement? Yes?
After.
Why?
Because you don't have to move anything over.
Well, you don't have to move anything over anyway. Well, you don't have to move. All right, let me just say this. You don't have to move anything before or after.
Because you can just add a new link.
Yeah, that's right, as we'll see in a minute. All right, so you said after, Michael?
I was going to say after.
Also after. Okay.
I was going to say after, because then you're only using the singly linked, which costs less storage.
I guess I'm not following your reasoning there.
Well, you said that if the list is only singly linked,
right,
then it uses half as much storage as if it was doubly linked.
True.
And if you're placing something after, all you're really caring about is the one that comes before it. So you're putting it after, so it uses less storage. I don't know. Made sense in my head.
You were doing all right until you got to the storage part.
Okay.
All right, well, let's think about how you would implement the before and after. So let's see. So let me see. So the before is solid. So after is the dotted. So R1 is referring to 1, and I want to insert 4 after 1. How do I do that? Walk me through the steps. In fact, I don't have to walk you through the steps. They're right here. Okay. Now, R1 refers to 1, and I want to insert after the value referenced by R1. So what do I do? How do I go from here to here?
I guess you replace the length from 1 to 2 and make it go to 4 instead and then make a new length of 4 to 2.
Exactly. That's right. That's all you do. Right? So you essentially do two assignments. Right? You assign this, and you also create a new link. Right? So we create a new link, you assign this to the new link, and then you assign a reference to the new link to here. That's it. You're done. Okay, you have inserted 4 after 1. Pretty easy. Now, I want to do before. So now I want to insert before 2. So I get the same picture. You see, this is why I had trouble understanding your idea about it takes more or less storage. It takes the same amount of storage either way. Right. Now, you're right. Using a doubly linked list would take twice as much storage, but that has nothing to do with this. Well, not quite true, but at least for this slide it is. How do I do this if R1 refers to 2? What's the problem here? I'm sorry?
I was just questioning why R1 would refer to 2 instead of 1.
Because one of the ways I can define the semantics of add is add it before the referenced element.
Okay.
All right? So if that's the semantics, then we assume that R1 is pointing to 2, and then I want to add 4 before 2, right, to get this. So what I want to do is I want to end up in the same picture regardless of whether I insert before or after. So that's why there's two pointers here, right? If I insert after, then R1 points here and I get this. If I do insert before, then R1 points here and I get the same thing. All right. So that's the reason I drew it like this. But the question is, how do I do that? How do I go from here to here? What's the issue here?
You don't know what's before.
Exactly. The problem is, remember, this is upstream. And I don't know anything about upstream because I don't have any references back to that. So if I want to insert, notice what I have to do here to insert something before 2. I still have to change the reference that the link containing 1 points to, which means I have to get a hold of that link. But I can't because I don't have a pointer to it. I'm only going downstream and not up. So what do I have to do? Exactly. I have to go all the way back to the beginning of the list, and then I have to chunk through link by link until I get to the link before 2. Then I can do this. Same set of assignments. I want to do the same set of assignments, but if R1 refers to 2, I don't have the reference to the link before 2. So I've got to go through the list and do that assignment and find that link. Again, I'm touching potentially. Notice that if this is all the way at the end of the list, I'm potentially touching every element in the list. Again, that's a bad thing to want to do.
So after
is probably going to be the right choice for this because that allows you to essentially insert a new value in constant time. Okay, I don't. What's wrong with that? There is one thing wrong. We're almost in heaven, but there's always that little serpent. Telling you to eat the apple. And what is that serpent here? What can't we do? Well, actually, I'll let you think about it. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Does it switch the references? The pointers, I guess. I guess thinking of in terms of what we were doing before where if that having the separate reference array to refer to the specific number or the value, and then when you do this, since you're kind of putting it in between, it shifts the references over to the right.
Actually, do I talk about that?
Might be making sense.
That's on the next slide.
Okay.
But yeah, I understand what you're saying, and I'll just give you the answer now. That's not a problem anymore. We don't have to worry about that.
Okay.
And the justification for that's on the next slide. All right, I will let you cogitate on that so we can just move on. So some other detail, and that's it, right? That's dynamically implemented linked lists. there are some details that we can talk about, and we'll get to those details at the end of a section here, if we have time. But that's principally all you need to know. There are some other things we can talk about, and the first one is what you mentioned. Now, what is a reference? Right? When we had an array, we could say that references to values in the list are just indices into the array. What do we say here? We no longer have an array, so what now are references to values in the list, the linked list now? Well, you have, again, a number of choices, but the most obvious choice is references are pointers to the values in the linked list. So now, rather than having indices into an array, I have pointers to values. Okay, the nice thing about that is I don't have to worry about invalidation anymore, because moving links around doesn't invalidate pointers to the values in those links, because I no longer have a positional notation for references. That takes care of your problem. It looks like you don't believe me.
No, I do.
Okay.
I was just thinking about it.
The traversal and navigation operations are pretty much the same. They don't affect the choice or the implementation of traversal and navigation operations. Well, that's actually not quite true. If you have a doubly linked list, then it makes sense to support both the next value and the previous value operations. Okay, because those are very easy to do. They're fast. Okay. If you have a singly linked list, then providing the previous value operation, navigation operation, can be expensive because you essentially have to go back to the beginning and count up. But that doesn't mean you can't provide it. That just means it's expensive, potentially expensive. All right, comparison. We have a new comparison. Again, same definition of fast and slow, single element operation versus potentially n element operation. Right, nothing changes here. Creation is fast. It's really fast, right? Because essentially you create an empty list, so you don't have to do anything except, you know, set a couple of values to whatever your null value is. Deletion is perhaps not quite as fast, but it's still reasonably fast. Adding is now fast. Right? We just argued a couple of slides ago that essentially if you want to add an element and you choose wisely, you want to add an element to a linked list. That's two assignments. That's fast. Similarly, with respect to removing, I haven't talked about removing things, but that should be clear. You just run the slide backwards or from bottom to top as opposed to top down. Traversal is still fast. You're just following links. It's a little bit slower than it is for arrays, right? Because you have in hardware, you have addressing for arrays, whereas you don't when you follow pointers. But the difference is small. Navigation, again, is still slow because we still have a sequential data structure, not a random access one. But the important thing is I can now stuff as many values as I want into my linked list. And I don't have to worry about running out, except, of course, for the physical limits of the machine, which we're not going to consider. So now we've been able to achieve what we wanted to all the way back on Tuesday. All right? Questions about that? All right, so in summary then, arrays are efficient, but can't change size. All right, linked lists are the reverse. They're dynamic, but less efficient. And then, again, that's not the way that you spell changing. There should be at least another G in there someplace. Changing the trade-off moves from one of these things to the other. And, of course, creates new versions, too. All right, any questions about that? All right, let's go here. And let's go here. And let's talk about list traversals, but before we do that, let me take attendance. All right, so now let's go on to the topic of tonight's discussion, which is list traversal. So the first thing I'll talk about is why bother doing traversals? What's the point? And then we'll talk about doing traversals with references. Once we satisfy ourselves that traversals are a useful thing to spend time on, we'll then try and think about how to do it. And we will start by using something that we already know about, which is references. And we will become disenchanted with references for reasons that we will discuss, and we'll move on to an alternative form of references, which are known as iterators, are fairly important. They're known as they have various names in different languages, but I'll call them iterators. And then once we have iterators, we can then go back and look at traversals again. All right, so first question is, why bother with traversals? What's the point? We had a question about the difference between traversals and navigation, right? So, I mean, is this such a big deal? Is it so very good? ADTs are commonly used to store and retrieve values. Right? That's how you can think about using an ADT. You put stuff in, you take stuff out. That's great. But it's also very useful to think about ADTs in terms of the collected data in that data structure. Okay, so what we've done is we are, in a sense, thinking about ADTs now as a database where it's got not just individual values but a big group of values, which is true because that's what it is. Right? It turns out to be a very useful ability to essentially treat the ADT as a group of data, as opposed to a storage for individual items. Right? You know, it's nice to be able to get somebody's records, academic records, out of the database. But it's also nice to figure out, for example, how many people should be on the dean's list. And those are two significantly different uses of your database. So examples of treating collective data would be something like doing something to every element in or every value in your data structure. For example, give everybody a 10% pay cut to sort of keep up with the times. Figure out which students are on the dean's list. Move the more seriously injured people ahead of the less seriously injured people so that you can take care of the more serious cases first. Right? These are all things that don't operate on individual elements, or that rather they do operate on them, but they operate on them within the context of the entire set of values. Okay? Given the importance of these kinds of operations, how should an ADT support them? What kind of operations, group-oriented operations, should an ADT provide, and how should those operations be implemented? That's what we're going to look at here. Actually, we're not going to quite look at that, but that's going to be the start of our inquiries. So this is the issue we want to deal with, although I'm going to refine this as we go along. So what about these group operations? Does anybody fiddle around with databases here? Anybody use databases? What kind? Okay. Any Oracle people or anything like that, you know, big ones? Okay. What do we want for group operations? You can want a lot of things, but principally what we'd like to be able to do is cover a wide range of uses. Right? This is a fairly diverse set of operations. And, of course, this is only just three that I thought of sitting there writing these notes. There's lots of other ones you could think of. And in particular, whatever you can do to an individual value in a data structure, you can also do to a group of values. Like, for example, give an individual a 10% pay cut. Give everybody a 10% pay cut. Right? But you can also do more. Right? So whatever it is you support with respect to individual values in your abstract data type, you also want to support two groups of values. Furthermore, you can also go beyond the individual operations. Furthermore, it should be simple to use. And I'm actually not going to define simple. I'll just rely on your intuition. We'll sort of tiptoe near a definition of what it is as we go along. But principally, the issue here is that groups are more complex than individuals, not surprisingly. And that would lead you to believe that then group operations are also going to be more complex. And what you want to be able to do is control that complexity to make them easy to use. Notice that these requirements, as I indicated earlier, conflict. Right, simple group operations are not capable. Right, if I give you a simple set of operations, there's not a lot you can do with them. On the other hand, capable operations, generally speaking, are not simple, given the complexity that we're talking about up here. So here's another trade-off. Right? You can do simple things, but unfortunately, you don't have a very capable set of operations. On the other hand, you can do capable things, and your operations suddenly become a lot more complex. We're actually going to attempt to break that contradiction as we go along. So let's talk about what I mean by simple group operations. What I consider simple to be is high level. Okay, so these are high level operations that you perform on groups of data. So an example of that would be I have an emergency room data structure, which contains, for example, all the patients in the emergency room. And then I have this operation called critically ordered. Okay, which essentially goes through and orders the patients in the emergency room based on the seriousness of their, whatever it is, injury. Okay, the seriousness of their, what's the word I want? Begins with a C. I can't remember. God, don't get old, let me tell you. Huh? Condition, yes, sorry. The seriousness of their condition. And then I just want to look at the top 10. I want to look at the 10 most critical people in the emergency room and take care of them first. I want to perform triage. All right? So this is a pretty high-level operation. I just give it a parameter. How many of these critical people do you want to look at? And bang, you're done. All right? So this is a high-level operation. Very simple. Okay? But now suppose I want to look at all the patients and not just 10. What do I do then? Well, I can still deal with that, right? But I have to do a little bit more work. Now I do the same thing I did up here, except rather than call 10, I have to figure out how big, how many patients there are in the emergency room. Right? And you notice that this is not quite as simple as that, because I have to do this. So you can see that as I begin to want to do things that the operations don't support, I have to start doing more work. And even worse, now let's suppose that I'm interested only in a subset of those patients. So I'm only interested in patients that have flu-like symptoms, right? Because I have to rat on those people to the county board of health. Well, this isn't going to help me at all, because this is just ordering people by how critical their condition is. This doesn't do me any good whatsoever. All right, so I need something else. Okay? Now let's look at the other set, capable. I want operations that will let me do that. Low-level operations, or what I'm calling capable operations, operate on individual values and the ADT's adjacency relationship. Now this is actually just one definition of what it means to be low-level. Okay, and this is a definition that's appropriate for not only this data structure, but for this class. For those of you that are watching the factor video before this class started, that is another example of low-level traversals of data that is significantly more high-level than this is. But I'm not going to go into that. So what does the operation on the previous slide look like when we're talking about low-level group operations? Well, I need to create a roster to store the... Actually, I suppose I should call that triage to... and I did call it triage here, but I didn't change it here and here. So if you want, change this to triage. So these two occurrences of roster, change it to triage. Then we have what we had on the previous slide. So what do? I look at the first patient in the emergency room, and if there is, in fact, a patient there, and triage size is less than 11, so in other words, I want the first 10, then I look at the patient itself. Remember, this is a reference and not the patient. I look at the patient, and then if that patient has flu-like symptoms, I add it to the roster. Okay, and then I go on and do the next. All right, so this clearly gives me what I'm looking for. It gives me the 10 patients in the emergency room, or up to 10 patients in the emergency room that have flu-like symptoms. Okay, this does exactly what I wanted to do. But you can't call this simple, right? Because there's all these details that you have to manage. So that's the trade-off. The trade-off is whether you're going to provide things like this that are simple to use but have limited application. In other words, I have to sort of bend things a little bit to get the entire roster, and in some cases, I just can't use this at all. Or you have something like this, which now notice that I could do all kinds of things with this. Right? I just by changing the things that I call, changing the tests that I use, I can create all kinds of manipulations on the groups. The problem is I increase the complexity with which it requires that work be done. So that's the trade-off. You can have simple, high-level operations or capable, low-level operations. And that's a choice you can make. It's up to you. I believe I talk a little bit about that. Simple versus capable. As a practical matter, general purpose, sort of as a rule of thumb, I guess, general purpose ADT should provide both simple and capable group operations. Less general ADT should favor simple group operations. So in other words, less general ADTs are more specific to a task. And in that case, it makes sense to provide things like this. Because you're only going to use those ADTs for that particular task. You're only going to use the ER ADT to manage emergency rooms. So it makes sense to have operations on that ADT that are catered towards the emergency room. On the other hand, if you're writing general purpose data structures like linked lists, because anything can use a linked list, then you want to go to the more capable operations, because you don't really know what kind of operations, group operations that it needs to support. All right, so less general ADTs, more specific ADTs should favor simple group operations. More general ones should favor capable ones. With that split, anybody have any questions about that? Because that turns out to be a useful way to think about things. All right. If we have that split in our head, we can now define what progress is. Right. Progress is the movement from capable group operations to simple ones without losing capability. All right. So in other words, we can do the same things that we were able to do before. We make progress. We have better abstract data types when we can do the same things we were able to do before with less effort. Okay. So we have progress when we can start here and then sometime later end up with doing something like this. As far as we're concerned, for this class, what we're interested in is general purpose ADTs, and consequently, we want to be supporting capable as opposed to simple group operations. All right, questions about that? So now, yes, sorry.
So the basic premise is add simplicity without losing capability?
Exactly. Okay. And the question is, how do you do that? That's a really interesting question in language design. We're not going to go anywhere near the kinds of things that you can... the kinds of ways you can approach that problem. But still, it's an interesting thing to think about if you're interested in language design. And, for that matter, library design, ADT designs, too. Okay. How do we do that? What are we going to do to satisfy that requirement, provide capable operations on general-purpose ADTs? Well, to a certain extent, we've already answered that question, right? In the previous lecture, we talked about the idea of a reference, a reference to values in the abstract data type. We can use those references to give us perhaps what is the simplest approach to capable group operations. I can't think of anything that would be simpler to use than using references, treating essentially each value individually. All right. So how do we use references to provide these capable group operations? Well, what do group operations need to be able to do? They need to access and perhaps manipulate values in the abstract data type, right? They need to look at each student, figure out what their GPA is, and whatever else they use to determine who's on the dean's list. Right? They need to access each patient and look at their EKGs and their pulse rate, if that's not the same thing. I guess it is. Respiration rate and so forth. And furthermore, because they are group operations, they need to go from one value to the next. Not only do they have to look at an individual student's GPA, they have to look at every student's GPA. Well, references do that. References do both of those things. Notice that references themselves don't look at GPAs, but they give you the ability to look at a GPA and make a further decision. Okay. And then, of course, references can move among the elements in the abstract data type, assuming that you've given those operations on references. References help provide, or at least give us the ability to say, well, we have capable group operations now. The only problem is you have to assemble it. I guess you could think of this as like the IKEA of operations, right? You go to your abstract data type, you get a big box, you take it home, you open it up, and there's parts and screws all over the place. You just assemble it, and bang, you can go. What's the difference there? Why is that not a good analogy? It's not a good analogy because if you go to IKEA and bring a box back, you can build a coffee table or a bookcase, and that's it. You can't do, if you bought a bookcase, you're going to build one, unless you're clever and maybe turn it into a platform bed or something. Here, you can do whatever you want. You can use code to do whatever you want, so that's why the analogy is not quite as I had indicated. Here's an example. What I want to do is I want to order emergency room patients in decreasing critical state. Notice that this is different from, no it isn't, it's the same. Oh, I thought I had a different one. Oh, well. So how do you do that? What's another term for this? There's a one-word description of what this is. One-term description for what this operation describes. No. I thought somebody said it. Not sequential. What is the operation I'm doing here? Sorting, exactly, sorting. This is a sort. And that's a characteristic of a capable set of operations, group operations. I can sort the data. So this is a selection sort, as you will find out, I guess, all the way at the end of the semester. But compare this to this. Right? If we assume that decreasing criticality means what it says, these two things do the same. Okay, but it's clear that this is far simpler to use than this is. Because this one I have to assemble on my own, whereas this one comes ready-made. That's another way to think about it. The problem is, of course, if I don't want to do this, suppose I want to have increasing critical state, so I want to look at the patients that are the least sick first and then go on to the more complex ones. I'm a lazy doctor. I don't want to do the hard work. Right. I know how to fix this. This, I don't know what to do. Well, actually, I do know what to do. What do I do? Let's assume that I can't do that. Yeah, I could do that. But there's another thing I could do here. I actually talked about this, I believe, on Tuesday. What do I get? I get a list that goes in decreasing severity, so I just turn the list around. So I just say er.decreasingcriticality.reverse. So if I provide the reverse operation on the sequence of data, oh, that was something I wanted to mention here. Do I want to go back?
Probably.
All right. You talk me into it. I won't torture you since we're running out of time. Notice that this is a manipulation operation as we defined it on ADTs. This is a query operation, and this is a... maintenance operation, right. Because this is, in a sense, changing the abstract data type, but not changing the data. So this is changing the before and after relationship, but that's all. So it doesn't change the data. So again, that tripartite division into maintenance, query, and manipulation holds here, too. Okay. So that shows us that we have, in fact, already taken care of the need for capable group operations if you provide references with the appropriate operations. All right, questions about that? Now, if you remember, we started off this lecture by asking, the question, well, traversals, what about that? Now we can talk about traversals. References essentially just move among values and access those values in an ADT. Value access and manipulation depends upon the group operation you're performing. Right, how you move among the values and what you do at each one of those values depends on the operation. Right? If I sort them, I'm going to do one set of movements and perform certain sets of operations. If I'm looking for the D's list, I'm going to do something else. Moving through the values is independent for the most part. You can argue the opposite, which would be a reasonable argument to make. Moving is independent, more or less, of the group operation. So independent of what I want to do at each value is the way in which I move among the values. So in a sense, what I'm trying to do is split those things so I can break them apart and treat them as separate components. Focusing on simpler forms of moving through values is one way of creating simpler group operations. Remember, I said that progress goes from capable operations to simple ones without losing capability. But I didn't tell you how we're going to do that. Explicitly, anyway. All right. This is one of the ways, one of the many ways in which you can do that. What you can do is you can come up with more cliched, if you will, ways of moving through the data. These cliched kinds of approaches to moving through the data are known as traversals. Okay, a traversal is a simpler, more organized form of moving through ADT values. So what we're doing is we're taking a look at one of the two parts of a group operation, the movement part, and we're trying to say, how can we abstract that movement part out of all these different group operations and provide it as its own operation? Okay, and when you do that, you get a traversal. And this goes back to your question about navigation versus traversal, right? Of course, you do traversal using navigation operations. But the point is, traversals are cliched in the sense that, you know, we begin at the beginning and we go to the end and we stop. Whereas navigation, you can do whatever you want. You can jitterbug back and forth. It's up to you. And in fact, I have an example of that. Okay? Questions about that? So that's what a traversal is. However, before we get there, references, it turns out, depending upon how you implement them, of course, but references, generally speaking, are too powerful for just traversing data. Okay, notice that because we've divorced traversing from access, now what we're really interested in is just the ability to go left and right. To put it crudely. Okay. If that's all I'm interested in, all the other stuff that references do, all the other operations, I should be more specific, all the other operations that references do having to do with values and such don't really matter. I don't need them. So if I'm interested in looking at traversals, references are, in a sense, more than I need. In other words, they're too complex. What I'd like to do is simplify them. There's that word again. And, of course, this depends on how references are defined. You can just define references as a pure traversal mechanism, in which case this is wrong, but generally speaking, you're not going to do that because you do want to be able to get access to values. Manipulating, as I just said, manipulating is not so important for traversals. I don't really care. I mean, I'll just hand that off to the code that's using the traversal code. Neither are fancy relative reference operations. Okay, you can think about, you know, moving forwards or backwards relative to a criteria or whatever. You don't really need to do that. Simplified references are easier to use, and generally speaking, they're more efficient in execution because they don't do as much. All right, so these simplified kinds of references are, well, they have lots of different names, but as far as we're concerned, we're going to call them iterators. So an iterator is essentially a reference, but it's in a simplified form. Okay? Now, I should say that I am probably drawing the picture a lot more sharper than it actually is. If you look at real languages, if you look at Java, for example, it's kind of difficult to tell the difference between references and iterators, because they look more or less the same. Not quite. I mean, iterators are more limited than general purpose references. But for the most part, you have to sort of pretend that you see the difference, because it may, in fact, not be quite as clear in the language itself. So where do we get these iterators? Where do they come from? Well, pretty much the same as for references. So, for example, you could do things like look for a particular value and return the iterator to that value. Right? You can return an iterator to the first value in the list. You can return an iterator to the last. You can go to the next. You can go to the previous. So, again, this is pretty much like it is for references, except now we're returning iterators. You can build other iterator-creating operations on this, or you can add more complex ones. But again, the point here is to try and keep things simple. For example, you don't need this one. Right? You can cobble up your own code that begins at the beginning, goes through to the end, and looks for a value of type T. Right? So you don't really need this one. You can get rid of it and implement it yourself. On the other hand, if that's the kind of thing that people using your ADTs are going to be doing a lot of, then it might make sense to provide that operation as part of the ADT so that people don't have to repeatedly recode this over and over again. That's actually an interesting question in software design, which we're not going to get into. All right, questions? To what does an iterator refer? Well, to a certain extent, we've answered that question, right? I mean, it's a reference, so it refers to values in the abstract data type. There's an alternative point of view. And that alternative point of view says we're not going to, an iterator doesn't refer to the value itself, but it refers to the representation of that value in the abstract data type. So with respect to linked lists, if I have an iterator to a value in the linked list, what I have is a reference to the link and not to the value. So those, and in fact, there are other choices that you could make. You could use indirection if you wanted to, but it's not quite clear why you'd want to use indirection here. Which one should you use? Should an iterator refer to, and what's the difference between the two? Why is there a difference there? Are they different? Maybe they're not. Maybe they're the same. Maybe I can throw this slide away. So are they, well, I'll just answer it for you. They are actually different. And I'll leave it up to you to puzzle through why they're different. My argument is you don't want to have iterators return internal details of the abstract data type. So an iterator should refer to the value and not to the representation of that value within the data structure. Other people would argue differently. And in fact, the book that I used for this course in the previous semester did this. So when you got an iterator back from a linked list, you received a pointer to the link and not to the value. So you can do it either way. My argument for returning pointers or references to values as opposed to links is because returning the links exposes implementation detail. This is software engineering. And what you want to do is you want to hide the implementation details so that you can change it, which is something that we'll talk about on, well, as we go along and look at different implementations of the same data structure. All right, how do we implement iterators? It actually turns out to be pretty straightforward. An iterator is just like a reference. It's a class. It has a type. All right, so you essentially would construct a type, and in this case, we called it iterator. Because I just argued that you want to hide implementation details, the iterator itself should be implemented within the linked list. And that essentially makes the list manipulations be simple and secure because you essentially have access to everything you need. If you're outside, if you implement the iterator outside the linked list, then you have to provide access to the internals of the linked list, and it gets to be a real mess. So the easiest thing to do is implement the iterators inside the linked list, which is essentially what this argument is. Because an iterator is a class, then it has some methods that you can use to operate. You can have various predicates. You can ask whether or not an iterator is at the beginning of a list or the end of the list. You can determine if two iterators are equal. You can get the value associated with an iterator, so forth and so on. You can imagine other kinds of operations on iterators. One important thing you need to do is make sure that you distinguish between operations on iterators and operations on values in the list. And in particular, that's an important characteristic for determining what equals is. What are the two choices for implementing equals here? Two ways of interpreting the semantics of equals. Well, actually, there's a lot more than two, but the two principal ones that we've been talking about up to this point. So the question is, what does it mean for iterators to be equal? And this is actually an operation you need to provide. Right? This is not something that you can think about blowing off for the most part. So you do have to actually give some small amount of thought to what the semantics of such an operation will be. I don't think in the assignments you have to worry about it. But well, we're not going to finish this tonight. So I guess we could just sort of stand here and pound on this. Well, what things are you dealing with? What kinds of, what are the possibilities for equality? Yes?
Integers?
I guess I don't understand that answer.
Well, are you talking about that thing right there?
Yes. What is the semantics of this? If this returns true, what does that mean?
Value that the iterator returns is equal to the value that you asked it for?
Okay, I'll take that, since I haven't actually defined.
I don't know.
No, that's fine. So one way to define equals between iterators is they point to values that are equal. That's essentially what you said. Right? If you think about it, yeah, sure. I mean, if I have two iterators and they both point to the value 3, then those iterators are equal. So that's certainly one way you can define equals. What is another way? And this actually has an analogy in Java. So if this looks familiar, if the question sounds familiar from your Java experience, then it's probably relevant. So what's an alternative definition for equals among iterators? It's almost equivalent, but not quite, to what, was it David? Ham just said. See, now it's getting dangerous because now when I'm learning your names, I can start to call on you. You still got a couple weeks yet. Well, actually, the difference is between the difference between identity and similarity. Did they talk about this in wherever it was, 175, 176? You can have two things that are similar or two things that are identical. David just gave me the definition of similarity. So the other alternative is to think about equals as being identical. And what would you expect that definition of identical to be? similar things are alike, and identical things are the same. Sorry.
If the syntax of the iterators is exactly the same?
I guess I don't know what the syntax of the iterator means.
Like the methods by which it operates, I guess?
No, no, I'm just talking about this. So the other alternative is that the two iterators reference the same thing.
Isn't that what he said?
No, he said something different. He said similarity.
Well.
Versus identity. If two things are identical, then they're similar. But if two things are similar, then they're not necessarily identical. And the difference in Java is actually, this isn't quite true, but let's assume it is. It's the equality, or the equals object method versus the equal-equal operator. Right? Equal-equal essentially is identity. That's true if the two references are to the same object instance or class instance. Whereas dot equals could potentially be, they have the same value, but they don't necessarily refer to the same object instance. So those are the two definitions of equals. And in fact, there's a lot more. A common Lisp has like 7 different definitions of equals. So you can define all different kinds of ways. I think at this point, we'll stop. Any questions? All right, seeing no questions, have a good weekend.